The IAEA says Iran has informed the agency of its decision to remove 27 of the UN watchdog's cameras from its nuclear sites. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says his country will not back off a single step from its position a day after IAEA passes an anti-Iran resolution. And another mass shooting in the U.S., a gunman kills at least three people at a manufacturing plant in Maryland. Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. Our top story, head of the International Atomic Energy Agency says Iran has informed IAEA of its plans to disconnect 27 cameras of the agency from its nuclear sites.
Basically, what we have been informed is that 27 cameras like this, you remember in December we were showing these cameras on a more auspicious time where we were reinstalling cameras. 27 cameras are being removed. In Iran, apart from an online enrichment monitoring system that we have over there.
Rafael Grossi said Iran will remove all extra surveillance cameras installed under the 2015 deal. He said presence of cameras was beyond a comprehensive safeguards agreement, but according to Grossi, some 40 cameras which were installed under the safeguards issues will remain in place. This after Iran switched off two of the surveillance cameras, saying their activity was beyond its commitments under that agreement. Meanwhile, head of the Iran's Atomic Energy Organization has slammed a nuclear watchdog for its anti-Tehran stance, saying that it's fully under the Israeli regime's influence. Mohammad Islami was reacting to his country's relations with the International Atomic Energy Agency and the latest anti-Iran resolution adopted by its board of governors. He said Iran inked a deal with world powers and accepted restrictions on its peaceful nuclear program in order to build trust. He said the latest move at the IAEA is contrary to Iran's goodwill gestures. Islami also expressed regret the agency's reputation is being thrown into question because it's being exploited by the Israeli regime. He added the IAEA and other international bodies have become hostages to Zionists. Iran's president says Tehran stands firm on its position with regard to an anti-Iranian resolution adopted by the IAEA. Ebrahim Raisi said Iran will not back off a single step from its position. Raisi said Iran's development in various sectors is not tied to its enemies' reproaches. This after the UN Nuclear Agency approved a resolution which accused Tehran of inadequate cooperation. On Wednesday, the agency passed resolutions submitted by the U.S. and its three European allies. Iran condemned the move, saying countries that push for the resolution but their agenda ahead of the agency's credibility. Members of anti-Iran terrorist group the MKO have attacked a reporter and accompanying news team of Press TVs while reporting on an exhibition held in Stockholm on the group's crimes. Bianca Rahimi tells us more.
This is the moment an exhibition turned into a series of violent assaults committed by the MKO, a cult-like organization that has the blood of 17,000 Iranians on its hands. Press TV's camera crew, reporting on an exhibition showcasing MKO bombings and assassinations, was attacked by angry supporters of the group.
Don't touch my camera. Don't touch my camera.
Go deep.
Don't touch my camera.
You go deep.
After being driven out of post-revolution Iran, the MKO based itself in Camp Ashraf in Iraq, where members were forced to pledge allegiance to its leader Massoud Rajavi and demonstrate that allegiance with cult-like behavior for women that meant divorcing their husbands and marrying him. Many families spent years on the fringes of the camp begging for their children to be released, but to no avail. The camp was later dismantled in the wake of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Until 2012, the MKO was on the U.S. terrorist list. It was also blacklisted by the EU until 2009. Since being removed, the new leader of the cult, Mariam Rajavi, has forged close relationships with Western officials.
What unfolded on the streets of Stockholm today was a shocking reminder that the EU has become a safe haven for the MKO, which attacks journalists like myself with little fear of retribution. The question now is, will there be an investigation? Bianca Rahimi, Stockholm.
Earlier, we were joined by historian and social activist Olsi Jazikshi. He says that members of the MKO group have a long history of terrorist activities against democratic institutions and free speech.
This is not the first attack that the MKO is doing against the free media. They have a long history of terrorist activities and attack against democratic institutions. The Mujahideen Al Halq terrorist organization, in the past, they have even killed American officials. And the very nature of this cult is against democracy and free speech. Since their coming or their massive coming to Albania in 2016, the Mujahideens, they have attacked dozens of Albanian journalists and medias. They have attacked and beaten journalists from Channel 4, a British channel, and they have verbally abused and attacked The Guardian, The Independent, the BBC, and Al Jazeera. So what happened today in Sweden is nothing new from this cult. This cult, they do not accept debate, they do not accept opposing views, because they live in a totalitarian cult-like society. For people who know the organization of the Mujahideen al-Halq cult in Albania, they know that these people, they abuse even their own members. Their members, who are held as slave soldiers in Albania, they are not allowed to contact their families, they are not allowed to surf the internet, or they are not even allowed to communicate with the outside world.
The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement says the arrival of an Israeli gas drilling vessel in Lebanese territorial waters is an act of provocation. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah said the Israeli operation in the disputed waters poses a challenge to Lebanon and its right to use its own natural resources. He stressed the issue is as important as the liberation of Lebanese land from Israeli occupation. Hassan Nasrallah urged the people to take a united stand to prevent Israel from exploiting the country's resources. He called it a political move for not allowing Lebanon to conduct drilling in its territorial waters. Hezbollah leaders said the U.S. and Israel have been trying to discourage different companies from collaborating with Lebanon. Israeli forces fatally shoot another Palestinian in the occupied West Bank city of Halul. Palestinian Health Ministry says regime soldiers opened fire on 27-year-old Mahmoud Fayez Abu Ayyur. Medical sources said six Palestinians were also injured in clashes with Israelis on Thursday. Witnesses said the latest episode started after Israeli troops raided a currency exchange office. Israel has recently ramped up deadly attacks on Palestinians, conducting near daily raids throughout the West Bank. More than 20 Palestinians, including prominent journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, have been killed in Israeli violence since March. Earlier, we're joined by our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Candil, for more on the story.
It seems that the Israelis, every time they raid Palestinian areas, and we have to say that almost on a daily basis, Israeli soldiers raid and storm Palestinian cities, villages, towns, and refugee camps, claiming that they want to arrest Palestinians who are accused for security reasons. But this time, it's another story. They claim that the raid is in order to close this exchange business shop. And the clashes have erupted, or the fighting erupted in that area, Halhoun, near Al-Khalil. We have also to say that in other areas in the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces have raided several areas of the occupied West Bank this morning and arrested at least 11 Palestinians. Also, those Palestinians were accused for being wanted for security reasons as well. There are clear orders from the military establishment to the Israeli soldiers that they have the green light to use their fire in order to shoot and kill Palestinians. This is why the Palestinian Authority or Palestinian Foreign Ministry consider that the killing of Palestinians in these cases would be extrajudicial killing or assassinations.
Now, there seems to be no end in sight to gun violence in America. Police say at least three people have been killed in another mass shooting Smithsburg, that's a town in Washington County, Maryland. Shooting took place inside a manufacturing plant. Local officials say the suspect was shot and injured during exchange of fire with police, and later police said the suspect was no longer a threat. Gun violence comes as three other cities are still grieving from mass shootings. Recently, at least 35 people were killed in separate incidents in Buffalo, New York, at an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas, and a medical office building in Tulsa, Oklahoma. U.S. stocks plunge ahead of a key government report on soaring consumer prices and after the European Central Bank joins the Federal Reserve in the battle against inflation. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell about 2%, while the broad-based S&P index dropped about 2.5%. The tech-rich NASDAQ Composite Index also shed nearly 1% in Thursday's trading. That's as all eyes are now focused on the Labor Department's Consumer Price Index for May, which is expected out on Friday. The data is likely to show another big jump in annual inflation. Rising inflation has prompted the European Central Bank to join a growing number of central banks to seize easy money policies. The U.S. Federal Reserve started raising interest rates in March. Hospitals throughout France are deeply impacted by a strike for medical personnel. French public health used to be ranked the best on the planet, but austerity has caused a sharp decline in the quality of care. Rami Mazahari has her story out of Paris.
With unions showing rare unity, hospitals were brought to a near halt across France due to a major strike. Since the Great Recession began, seemingly no group in France, other than the Yellow Vests, have protested more often than medical workers. France's healthcare system was ranked number one in the world as recently as the year 2000 by the United Nations. However, its quality has plummeted following over a decade of banker bailouts and austerity cuts. Neoliberal economics as applied to public healthcare has created too many complaints by medical workers to list. Frozen salaries, slashed budgets, overwork, closed hospitals, a lack of equipment, gutted morale, and much more. Thousands of medical workers who refused orders to get coronavirus vaccines haven't been reintegrated, even though corona restrictions have ended in France. And that has created even more labor problems.
When you don't replace workers who retire or quit, then you're going to have longer wait times for critical medical care and worsened medical care overall. It's just gotten harder and harder to work at a hospital every year. We now have so few personnel that it feels like every single day is a strike day.
The degraded service has been dramatic and a common topic across France for years. The healthcare system is used by everybody, so politicians haven't been able to limit the negative impact to just the lower classes.
After 5 years of Macron, our healthcare system is in a state of catastrophe. We're seeing more and more people die from a lack of treatment. We have the money inside France already. Just tax the rich and businesses. Go after tax evasion and stop focusing public policy on the richest 20% of society. If we do that, then we'll have good public services and good health care.
The first round of legislative elections are less than a week away. The strike is a black eye for President Emmanuel Macron, just as he's trying to preserve his absolute majority in Parliament, which is crucial for him to be able to force through more neoliberal austerity measures. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
The battle for the city of Severodonetsk in eastern Ukraine is entering a crucial stage, with President Volodymyr Zelensky admitting fate of the Donbas region is tied to who will eventually control the city.
Severodonetsk remains the epicenter of the encounter in Donbas. As a result of this day and night, already the 105th day of a full-scale war, we are defending our positions and are inflicting tangible losses to the enemy. This is a very brutal battle, very tough, perhaps one of the most difficult throughout this war. I am grateful to each and every one who is defending this direction. Largely, that is where the fate of our Donbas is being decided now.
The Ukrainian army has pulled back to the city's outskirts, but says it will keep on fighting for as long as it takes. Vast parts of the city have been destroyed Local mayor is accusing the Russian forces of striking residential buildings. Severodonetsk is the last major city in Luhansk province, still in government control. The Ukrainian government, that is now Luhansk and Donetsk, formed the Donbass region, which Moscow is trying to control. The Kremlin says Russian forces now control 97% of Luhansk. Pro-Russian forces held around a third of the Donbass region before beginning of the conflict in late February. A debate in the European Parliament hears scathing criticism regarding the EU's role in the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. EU leaders are accused of not putting enough effort into a diplomatic solution. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
The majority of the EU's 705 legislators do support the 27-nation bloc's handling of the Ukraine conflict, but a growing minority are very unhappy. On the issue of sanctions, the EU has been accused of double standards and hypocrisy. When dissenting voices in the European Parliament highlight Ukraine's history of corruption or the need for greater diplomatic efforts with Russia, they are often shut down.
Please, dear colleagues, try to do preventive diplomacy. As somebody who has gone through
you
the
have
war,
to come to
I know
end.
That war does not resolve anything. Thank you.
Mainly due to the conflict, energy and food prices continue to soar in the EU, placing enormous financial hardship on citizens. Despite this, it seems the focus remains fixed on weapons.
Our unprecedented military support package of €2 billion under the European peace facility helps Ukraine defend its population.
Some analysts blame NATO and the EU, directed by the United States, for provoking Russia into military action.
And now, for Ukraine, it's a very bad situation. For Russia also, and for Europe, it's a very bad situation.
Any of the 27 leaders in the EU can veto key policies in the European Council. For example, Hungary has been blocking a total ban on Russian oil imports. Some lawmakers want the veto option to be scrapped.
For 1 month, we put our indecisiveness out on full display. What was the outcome? The perception that one member state won and the EU as a collective lost.
Other lawmakers disagree. They say it would be yet another example of the EU moving away from being a peace project and towards becoming a federalist superpower to benefit big business, including the arms industry. Jerome Hughes, the European Parliament, Brussels.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The US president has gradually morphed into a carbon copy of Trump when it comes to West Asia policy, says David Hurst, journalist, in an article published under the heading "Biden is fiddling as Al-Quds burns." Stay tuned for more. Quietly and without a murmur, the West Asia policy of US President Joe Biden appears to be performing what stunt riders call a handbrake turn. Biden is veering away from his signature policy and lurching towards Saudi normalization with the Israeli regime, which was the major piece of unfinished business of former President Donald Trump's Abraham Accords. After this stunt has been performed, Biden's West Asia policy will be all but indistinguishable from Trump's. For all his naked mercantilist ambitions, backing illegitimate despots in return for his 30 pieces of silver, Trump's legacy in West Asia is enduring. Having denounced both its de facto ruler and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia itself as a pariah state, Biden seems to be only too willing to deal with pariahs. He's following sheep-like in Trump's footsteps. As is by now well known, the Crown Prince and future King of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, has set normalization with the fabricated regime of Israel as his primary foreign policy goal. Chumming up to then Israeli regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in clandestine meetings was the young prince's path to getting his name recognized by the White House and to building a relationship with the Trump dynasty. But his father, King Salman, still retains ownership of and pride in Saudi Arabia's brokerage of the Arab Peace Initiative 2 decades ago, which promised Arab recognition of the fabricated regime of Israel only once it reached a negotiated settlement with the Palestinians. This was the last serious opportunity for a regional peace deal, and at the time it was ignored by the Zionist regime. The Abraham Accords have reversed this principle by sidelining Palestinians, whose fate is irrelevant to the deals being made between the UAE, Egypt, Bahrain, Morocco, and the fake regime of Israel. Biden, whose administration started by echoing King Salman's concerns about the Abraham Accords, is now falling increasingly into an unholy embrace with his son. It's unlikely to work to report on a conflict, as Shirin Abu Akleh died for Al Jazeera is to court a targeted Israeli regime sniper attack, which Al Jazeera is now bringing to the International Criminal Court as a war crime perpetrated by the Zionist regime. To bury her body is to court the blows and bullets of Israeli regime police. To fly a Palestinian flag is apparently now licensed for lethal force from those who get heavy police escorts to parade Israeli regime flags all around Palestinian headquarters. Asked specifically to condemn the police attacks on the coffin bearers, Biden gave a Trump-like response, saying, "I don't know all the detail, but I know it has to be investigated." When Trump was confronted by evidence that his protege MBS had ordered the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, he said something similar. It could very well be that the Crown Prince had knowledge of this tragic event. Maybe he did, and maybe he didn't. We may never know all the facts surrounding the murder of Mr. Jamal Khashoggi. Both U.S. presidents deliberately and persistently looked the other way to foster an alliance between the two least stable forces in West Asia, the Zionist regime and Saudi Arabia. How much longer Biden can look away on events about to unfold in Al-Quds is another matter. The Judaization of occupied East Al-Quds, the now weekly police raids on Al-Aqsa Mosque, the calls for Dome of the Rock to be dismantled, the attacks on Palestinians waving their national flag, all make this city a far more potent bomb. Trump's decision to move the U.S. embassy there, followed by a Biden administration that refuses to move on its promise to reopen its consulate for Palestinians in occupied East Al-Quds, leaves Washington incapable of applying a brake on the Zionist regime's plans for the city. U.S. foreign policy has been taken by surprise on too many occasions in the last three decades. The U.S. regime was surprised by the results of its invasion of Iraq. It was surprised by the sudden collapse of Kabul after so much time and money had been spent propping it up.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Lovely listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Muslim Lady. In the studio with me, I have the privilege and honor of being joined by Sister Salma Khalfan. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Alaykum salam wa rahmatullah.
Thank you so very much for being with us, sharing your time with us.
The pleasure is mine.
Thank you. During these last few episodes of Muslim Lady, we've been discussing the identity of a mother and how it's important for any mother, especially a Muslim lady, to find, to rediscover, refind in a way, the value within that identity that Allah has bestowed upon her through nature. Now, today, talking about value, obviously there's a strength that can be drawn from that, right? And Sister Salma, if you could just explain to us through which route does Islam give this strength to a Muslim lady? Because for the past, I would say, 300, 400-ish years, there's been this common misconception and misinterpretation of Islam and the practices a Muslim lady has within her religion, that Islam oppresses women and it does the complete opposite of empowering them, and it cages them and it degrades them and it's constantly forcing them to cover themselves and hide away in their homes and this and that. So when you say that if Islam gives them strength, you know, that's such a bold statement to be making. And how do we defend that? Because how does that happen?
First of all, we can see that Islam gives many rights to women. That is an empowerment in itself.
For sure.
Right? So the law of creation has made men and women in need of each other. In order to better unite men and women together and strengthen the family. The family is the main thing that actually unites this, the men and women, and gives strength to the woman. So this is the main basis of human prosperity. If men have been established as the ones for the women to financially rely on, women have been created for men to spiritually rely on.
Beautiful.
You know, so this empowers her, actually. A woman has so many tasks, but when she brings peace around her family, then she has actually done the best task ever, because she's given peace to her husband and she's given peace to her children around her also. And the children are the future leaders also. So we have to see that this woman is empowered, but sometimes she has to combat with herself a lot in the process, because she sees her husband as her friend and her, you know, like a partner to be so close to, not realizing the fact that there's an element of respect there to establish this power in her, if she wants to maintain that power, to keep it long-lasting, to not let go of, you know, to not lose her respect in front of her husband. So that will actually make her gain the power. And family is, the family issues, as we'll keep on looking at it, really provides a ground for her to get this power.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, and she has to look at it like that, you know.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Muslim Lady. We are going to go for a short break, so stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
When you said that if she relies on her man for financial support, then her man and her family basically rely on her for spiritual support and for that serenity that they so very much require in order to be able to function in this world, really. But what if that peace and serenity comes at her own expense? Who does the woman turn to for that peace that she obviously so very much needs as well?
Well, you know what? This is a plan that she has to undergo, first of all, through spouse selection. She can't just say that now, you know, like there are many people out there who are suffering because of the spouses are not compatible with them. And, you know, the blame is probably on the parents as well to have selected such spouses for them. In olden days time, you see, people were not given that much value and importance, you know, that they could select their spouses themselves. Sometimes it gets out of hand in this day and time also, because people, they don't want to get married and they keep on lagging behind. And probably they want Mr. Perfect to come along, and then they see that they've lost.
That
the age is gone by. So it's very important to have a balance in that, to have the elders' consent also here, as well as your own. The advice of the elders is very important.
Mm-hmm.
So when you see that in the case that you have asked that, you know, then whom should she turn to? It's actually her own fault. Now she has to learn how to be more patient. She has to grow it. Or she can choose another way. If she's so much in the intermediary level, like the barzakh, that she can't escape, then she should divorce. She knows that she's getting the worst of her, you know, her life. Then she should just separate.
Walk away, walk away.
If she knows that there are valid reasons, though.
Right.
Very valid reasons.
Mm.
But if they are just like in between, then she should improve herself.
Mm.
She should like maintain the power, as we will keep on seeing what are the requirements to build that power in her. That power is so beautiful that it's not like a physical power that you feel that, okay, your man is more powerful, he can give you security, he can give you money, he can provide for you. You are powerless. This is not the real power, if you go and see, is
for
it?
Sure, yes.
Like, does the zahiri things, the apparent things give you that power? No, the power is within the soul. That when you empower a person spiritually and emotionally, that's when you see that the man of the house has, like, a very good state of mind, and he can do more for the woman in turn. Yeah, but the woman has to be clever enough, the Muslim lady has to be clever enough to regard these things in her life, not to take it lightly. And the first aspect is the respect that should be given to her husband.
It's so important for a Muslim lady to understand that feminine energy she has within herself and to channel it in a way that demands respect, not in like a dictator, abusive sort of way, but the way she carries herself at home and in front of her spouse.
I'm talking about the respect she should also give to her
spouse. Absolutely, yes. It's a two-way
road.
Yeah, for sure.
when you were talking about empowering, it reminded me of all those women that I've seen around myself that were able to channel that feminine energy Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has rightfully blessed them with, and were able to earn the respect of their spouse by respecting him in return. And then they really wielded a sort of power that could really make or break that man, that family, that community even.
Yeah.
And that is such a powerful thing to be able to do,
yeah.
You know?
It depends on the way she's brought up or the things that she learns in her life, that she can now apply this respect, what she saw from her parents. Mm. It's very important. So upbringing comes here up, you know, like
yes,
together.
Yes.
So how she was brought up, then she can even give that same respect to the husband. How she was taught the values of how to, you know, enter a family.
Mm.
The values are very important, that she should be taught that, you know, when you enter a family life, don't be so like, you know, like free in your own like world that you think that, okay, now I have a life partner and I can do anything, like I can say anything to him.
Oh,
and I
being
can,
impulsive.
Yeah, she should have the heart that would do, those limits should be there. Like treating any human being, for
absolutely,
that matter, you know?
Yeah.
Like when we even treat our mother, we are close to our mothers,
yeah,
our parents, but we are so respectful too, right?
Yes.
And
yes,
that earns us more respect in turn and more sawabs in turn. So a parent, I mean, a wife should be careful on these things.
Mm-hmm.
When she's about to enter the marriage contract, she should know that adab is very important. Adab, the best, you know, like heritage that a parent can give to a child is adab.
Mm.
Adab of how to treat your husband, adab of how to react, as in like in anger and frustration or thinking whatever you want to say because he's my, you know, life partner, my spouse. I can say anything to him. Yeah, share with him. Have secrets with him, whatever. But maintain the respect. Know that he's a man and he has an ego and he needs to maintain his ego. Otherwise, if you break that ego, then the life will be broken.
Mm-hmm.
A man likes that he is the head of the family.
Yeah.
It is in his fitrat to feel that he wants to have the power. So you should respect him for that. And that will earn you respect in turn.
For
know?
Sure.
It's
for
a beautiful
sure.
thing that they will earn so much respect in turn that decision making will be even done with their consent.
Mm.
And in a subtle way, a woman can get whatever she wants, you know. The scholar said that a woman is so smart she can get whatever she wants.
Yeah, exactly.
So I guess with this respect, it's good qualities,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, if she's tactful enough, she can definitely do that. Do you think, from your experience of working with so many families in the community, that is it the case that if a woman does not pick up those skills from her family, because some families are really broken, then if she enters her family, then they're doomed and there's no hope for her? Or there is hope that perhaps she can learn from a certain stage onwards? Would you recommend couple counseling? Are these things helpful at all? And whether she can turn a new leaf to not repeat that vicious cycle of abusive families?
Yes, of course. They're all doors are open, you know,
mm.
for improvement. So if she feels, and she, you know, naturally a woman gets unhappy when she sees that there's no satisfaction in life going wrong with the family. And she will do something about it. But there are different ways to, you know, like do it. For example, she might just read about it. Or she might not have that strong initiative to keep on doing it,
mm.
you know, that will.
Mm-hmm.
She might do it for a day or two and see the repercussions. And if she keeps on dragging the same attitude, then of course, khasira dunya wal akhirah, she is lost in this world and the hereafter. But if she's smart enough, yes, she'll go for counseling. She will see what to do about it. She will also practice 1-2 in her agenda of how to go about it. And she will learn the hard way, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
You see? But she has to learn. And we've seen many people doing that. Huh? Like, I know of many olden folk who have actually, you know, like gone to marriages that are very unsuccessful. But they're doing sabr. They're like, you know, they've come up beautifully in their summer. They know that their partners are not compatible with them because they were not rightly selected in the first place. That's why spouse selection is of paramount importance. Very important. Think about it properly and then pros and cons and go forward if it's the right partner. In spite of all these difficulties along the lines, you will see that they've done their summer, they've given in, they have, you know, like struggled, they have had so much patience, and then they get it through their children. Or they get that appreciation in the end. Maybe they feel like sometimes that you see the one of the spouse getting sick and they're serving the sick spouse and the man realizes what he did, you know, was wrong.
Yeah.
And he does toba in the end. So now he or she is also the winner and so is the husband because he's done toba, right? He's regretted and he's turned to Allah and Allah is the all-merciful. He loves the tawabin, you see. So it's not like that there's a, you know, dead end in Islam. No, there's no dead end. And there are all the ways to search for. And, you know, now we have, everything is so open and replete. The world has become like a village.
Yeah.
So, you know, counseling, asking, seeking advice from elders, improving yourself. You know, the nafs is something that is like, if it lets go, it can create disaster.
Yes.
So that nafs is like a nafs al-lawwama. Everybody has that. You know, لا أقسم بالنفس اللوامة لا أقسم بيوم القيامة ولا أقسم بالنفس اللوامة. The nafs al-lawwama is a judgment in you to make. Like, so it'll tell you this, you're wrong. This is not right. In that process, if a person who is educated and wise enough, they'll think that I'm wrong in this way.
That's very important. You're right. And that's definitely something we're going to touch upon in further episodes of Muslim Lady. But that's all the time we have for today. Thank you so very much for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the United States, climate change and rapid population growth are shrinking the Great Salt Lake, creating a bowl of toxic dust that could poison the air around Salt Lake City. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Christopher Falvell. The piece is titled, As the Great Salt Lake Dries Up, Utah Faces an Environmental Nuclear Bomb. If the Great Salt Lake in the United States, which has already shrunk by two-thirds, continues to dry up, here's what's in store. The lake's flies and brine shrimp would die off. Scientists warn it could start as soon as this summer, threatening the 10 million migratory birds that stop at the lake annually to feed on the tiny creatures. Ski conditions at the resorts above Salt Lake City, a vital source of revenue, would deteriorate. The lucrative extraction of magnesium and other minerals from the lake could stop. Most alarming, the air surrounding Salt Lake City, Utah, would occasionally turn poisonous. The lake bed contains high levels of arsenic, and as more of it becomes exposed, windstorms carry that arsenic into the lungs of nearby residents, who make up three-quarters of Utah's population. We have this potential environmental nuclear bomb that's going to go off if we don't take some pretty dramatic action, said Joel Ferry, a Republican state lawmaker and rancher who lives on the north side of the Great Salt Lake. As climate change continues to cause record-breaking drought, there are no easy solutions. Saving the Great Salt Lake would require letting more snow melt from the mountains flow to the lake, which means less water for residents and farmers. That would threaten the region's breakneck population growth and high-value agriculture, something that state leaders seem reluctant to do. Utah's dilemma raises a core question as the country heats up. How quickly are Americans willing to adapt to the effects of climate change, even if those effects become urgent, obvious, and potentially catastrophic? The stakes are alarmingly high, according to Timothy Hawks, a Republican lawmaker who wants more aggressive action. Otherwise, he said, the Great Salt Lake risks the same fate as California's Owens Lake, which went dry decades ago, producing the worst levels of dust pollution in the United States and helping to turn the nearby community into a veritable ghost town. It's not just fear-mongering, he said, of the lake vanishing. It can actually happen. Say you climbed into a car at the edge of the Pacific Ocean and started driving east, tracing a line across the middle of the United States. After crossing the Klamath and Cascade Mountains in Northern California, green and lush, you would reach the Great Basin Desert of Nevada and western Utah. In one of the driest parts of the United States, the landscape is a brown so pale it's almost grey. But keep going east, and just shy of Wyoming, you would find a modern oasis. A narrow strip of green, stretching some 100 miles from north to south, home to an uninterrupted metropolis beneath snow-capped mountains, sheltered under maple and pear trees. At the edge of that oasis, between the city and the desert, is the Great Salt Lake. Utahns called the metropolis the Wasatch Front, after the 12,000-foot Wasatch Range above it. Extending roughly from Provo in the south to Brigham City in the north, with Salt Lake City at its center, it's one of the fastest-growing urban areas in the United States, home to 2.5 million people, drawn by the natural beauty and relatively modest cost of living. That megacity is possible because of a minor hydrological miracle. Snow that falls in the mountains just east of Salt Lake City feeds three rivers, the Jordan, the Weber, and the Bear, which provide water for the cities and towns of the Wasatch Front, as well as the rich cropland nearby, before flowing into the Great Salt Lake. Until recently, that hydrological system existed in a delicate balance. In summer, evaporation would cause the lake to drop about 2 feet in level. In spring, as the snowpack melted, the rivers would replenish it. Now two changes are throwing that system out of balance. One is explosive population growth, diverting more water from those rivers before they reach the Great Salt Lake. The other shift is climate change, according to Robert Gillies, a professor at Utah State University and Utah State climatologist. Higher temperatures cause more snowpack to transform to water vapor, which then escapes into the atmosphere rather than turning to liquid and running into rivers. More heat also means greater demand for water for lawns and crops, further reducing the amount that reaches the Great Salt Lake. And a shrinking lake means less snow. As storms pass over the Great Salt Lake, they absorb some of the moisture, which then falls as snow in the mountains. A vanishing lake endangers that pattern. If you don't have water, Dr. Robert Gillies says, you don't have industry, you don't have agriculture, and you don't have life. Last summer, as the water level in the Great Salt Lake reached its lowest point on record, and it's likely to fall further even this year, the lake's surface area, which covered about 3,300 square miles in the late 1980s, has since shrunk to less than 1,000 square miles, according to U.S. Geological Survey. The salt content in the part of the lake closest to Salt Lake City used to fluctuate between 9% and 12%, according to Bonnie Baxter, a biology professor at Westminster College. But as the water in the lake drops, its salt content has increased. If it reaches 17%, something that Dr. Baxter says will happen this summer, the algae in the water will struggle, threatening the brine shrimp that consume it. While the ecosystem hasn't collapsed yet, Dr. Baxter says, we're at the precipice, and it's terrifying. The long-term risks are even worse. One morning in March, Kevin Perry, a professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of Utah, walked out onto land that used to be underwater. He picked at the earth, the color of dried mud, like a beach whose tide went out and never came back. The soil contains arsenic, antimony, copper, zirconium, and other dangerous heavy metals, much of it residue from mining activity in the region. Most of the exposed soil is still protected by a hard crust. But as wind erodes the crust over time, those contaminants become airborne. Clouds of dust also make it difficult for people to breathe, particularly those with asthma or other respiratory ailments. Dr. Perry pointed to shards of crust that had come apart, lying on the sand like broken china. This is a disaster, Dr. Perry said, and the consequences for the ecosystem are absolutely insanely bad. In theory, the fix is simple. Let more water from melting snowpack reach the Great Salt Lake by sending less water towards homes, businesses, and farms. But metropolitan Salt Lake City has barely enough water to support its current population, and it is expected to grow almost 50% by 2060. The worst-case scenario for the Great Salt Lake is neither hypothetical nor abstract. Rather, it's on display 600 miles southwest, in a narrow valley at the edge of California, where what used to be a lake is now a barely contained disaster. In the early 1900s, Los Angeles, growing fast and running out of water, bought land along either side of the Owens River, then built an aqueduct diverting the river's water 230 miles south to Los Angeles. The river had been the main source of water for what was once Owens Lake, which covered more than 100 square miles. The lake dried up, and then for much of the 20th century, it was the worst source of dust pollution in America, according to a 2020 study by the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering and Medicine. When windstorms hit the dried lake bed, they pick up PM10, particulate matter 10 micrometers or smaller, which can lodge in the lungs when inhaled and has been linked to worsened asthma, heart attacks and premature deaths. The amount of PM10 in the air around Owens Lake has been as much as 138 times higher than deemed safe by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA. Local officials successfully sued the city of Los Angeles, arguing it had violated the rights of nearby communities to clean air. A judge ordered Los Angeles to reduce the dust. That was 25 years ago. Since then, the city of Los Angeles has spent $2.5 billion trying to keep wind from blowing dust off the lake bed. The city has tried different strategies, covering the lake bed in gravel, spraying just enough water on the dust to hold it in place, constantly tilling the dry earth, creating low ridges to catch restive dust particles before they can become airborne. The result is a mix between an industrial site and a science experiment. On a recent morning, workers scurried across the vast area checking valves and sprinklers that continually get plugged with sand. Nearby, inside a complex that resembles a bunker, walls of screens monitor data to alert the operation's 70-person staff if something goes wrong. If the carefully calibrated flow of sprinklers is disrupted, for example, dust could quickly start to fly off again. Dust levels near the lake still sometimes exceed federal safety rules, among Utah's coterie of nervous advocates for the Great Salt Lake. Owens Lake has become shorthand for the risk of failing to act quickly enough and the grave damage if the lake dries up, the contents of its bed spinning into the air. Of what used to be shore of what used to be Owens Lake is what's left of the town of Keeler. When the lake still existed, the town of Keeler was a boomtown. Today it consists of an abandoned school, an abandoned train station, a long-closed general store, a post office that's open from 10 a.m. to noon, and about 50 remaining residents who value their space and have lots of it. Cheap land, said Jim Macy when asked why he moved to Keeler in 1980. He described that period before Los Angeles began trying to hold down the lake bed as the time of dust. He recalled watching entire houses vanish from sight when the wind blew in. We called it the Keeler Death Cloud, Mr. Macy said.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio.
Coming up is the news.